Hey there, and welcome to Making Positive Psychology Work, the weekly podcast where we uncover tested practical ways to help people move from functioning to flourishing at work, so together we can better navigate the incredible challenges and opportunities our world faces. I'm your host, Michelle McQuaid, and what you probably don't know about me is that I was once quite the improvisation and theatre sports player. Oh yeah. Thank you so much for joining me for lesson number 58 of Making Positive Psychology Work. I'm so glad you're here because today we're talking to Professor Adam Grant, who's been Wharton's top-rated professor for 6 straight years. Adam is a leading expert on how we can find motivation and meaning and live more generous and creative lives. He's been recognized as one of the world's 25 most influential management thinkers, is the author of 3 New York Times best-selling books, and his TED Talks on original thinkers and givers and takers have been viewed more than 8 million times. His speaking and consulting clients include Facebook, Google, the NBA, Disney, Pixar, and the World Economic Forum, to name just a few, and he is the co-director of Wharton People Analytics. A passionate feminist who serves on the Leaning Board and the Defence Innovation Advisory Board at the Pentagon, and has earned awards for distinguished scholarly achievement from the Academy of Management, the American Psychological Association, and the National Science Foundation. But what you probably don't know about Adam is that he is a former magician and junior Olympic springboard diver. Welcome, Adam.
Thanks, Michelle. I'm long retired from both.
Me too. I have to confess, it's been a while since there were any theatre sports happening. Adam, it's such a privilege to have you with us on the podcast, particularly because you work with such an incredibly diverse range of organisations, most of whom seek you out for answers to the same issues of how to lead and manage people better. So given your research, what advice do you give them?
Oh, it varies quite a bit depending on the organisation. A lot of the requests that I get around are around trying to improve cultures. So I guess one of the first things that usually comes up is that it's really nice to have the right people on your bus, but it's critical to keep the wrong people off your bus. And yeah, I've found a lot of organizations invest a huge amount of time in trying to sort of maximize the chances that they hire quote unquote the right person, but they overlook the cost of hiring the wrong person in terms of the damage that can do to cultures. So we spend a lot of time trying to identify the traits that could actually be culturally toxic and then screen those out. And then beyond hiring, I spend a lot of time with organizations trying to figure out how they can improve their reward systems. I work with unfortunately, a lot of companies that say, look, we want people to be generous. We want them to collaborate, share their knowledge, help each other, provide mentoring. And then they only measure individual performance, which makes it really hard for those kinds of behaviors that are more other-focused to be valued. And so one of the things that I've enjoyed most is actually working on questions like, how do you find out who the people are who are not only achieving their own success, but elevating the success of others? And then how do you make sure those contributions are valued, rewarded, and promoted?
So what might companies do practically to figure that out and then reward the right behaviors?
Well, I think, you know, one of the more disturbing findings in the past few years, Rob Cross studied a whole range of companies across industries and found that on average, there was only about 50% overlap between the individual stars and the people who are adding the most value to others. Mm-hmm. And in some organizations, you can actually measure this behavior directly. So a favorite example is Corning. They made the Gorilla Glass for the iPhone and the iPad. And they said some years ago, look, you know, we really want to recognize and reward innovation. And we're going to have this Corning Fellows program where you get a job for life and a lab for life if you're named a fellow. People are like, wow, that sounds pretty amazing. How do I become a fellow? And, you know, most companies would do is they would look at the first criterion, which Corning used, which was if you're the lead author on a patent that's worth at least $100 million, they said, okay, you know, great. And a typical company would stop there because if you can drive that kind of innovation, we want to lock you up for life and then throw away the key. But Corning said no. They were worried that really, you know, in my framework of givers and takers, they were worried that, you know, that competent takers would pollute the culture and also that they would stop contributing after they were elected fellow. And so they included a second set of metrics, which involved things like, are you a supporting author on other people's patents? And I think this is ingenious because, you know, in their world of glass, it can take 9 or 10 years to get a patent. So there aren't a lot of people who are like, you know, Michelle, I'm going to pretend to help you for the next decade in the hopes that you will reward my fake generosity by making me the 43rd author on your pet. right? It's the people who day in and day out are trying to help each other solve problems that earn that later patent authorship. And Corning said you've got to do both. You have to show that you can drive your own success, but you also have to make other people more successful. And, you know, I think the question for most companies is, what is your equivalent of later patent authorship, where, you know, people's everyday helping and giving behaviors actually show up?
I think that's such a great way to think about it, because most of the organizations I've certainly worked in, the rewards have been very individually focused, and they do skew us more towards those taker-style behaviors that you talk so much in your wonderful book, Give and Take. And in your TED talk on this topic, you make the point about screening out the takers. But what do you do if you suddenly realize you've got a taker in your team that is making your culture more toxic? How do we deal with those people practically?
So I think you have three options. The first one is to recognize that very few people are takers in every role and every relationship. And so you want to observe, what are the moments where they seem to be less selfish, more generous, and what do those moments have in common? Because then you can start to tailor your requests toward, you know, the kinds of helping and giving that they naturally enjoy doing or they feel like they're skilled at. I worked with one organization where there was somebody identified as, you know, is just being extremely selfish by all of his collaborators. And they one day discovered that he really loved fly fishing. And so they would ask him about fly fishing. And he was so passionate about the sport that he couldn't help but share his knowledge. And then, you know, they would try to immediately jump in with their work questions right after that and hope that the enthusiasm would naturally spill over. But, you know, I do think there's value in figuring out, like, what do people enjoy, you know, sharing? Who are they most motivated to help? And then, you know, you can try to bring out more of those qualities in them. That's your first option. I think the second option is to say, look, if you're dealing with somebody who, you know, who seems to be sort of either have a history or a reputation of selfish behavior, then you don't want to reward that behavior by just giving to them sort of unconditionally. And so, you know, I've spoken and written a lot about this third style that a lot of people adopt called matching, where, you know, giving is about, I'll help you without keeping score. Taking is about, what can you do for me? Matching is about quid pro quo. You know, I'll do something for you if you do something for me. And I think what a lot of givers don't realize is that they have to shift into matcher mode when dealing with takers to say, look, you know, I'm going to hold you accountable for paying it back or paying it forward. Otherwise, you know, I'm just going to be rewarding and reinforcing your selfish behavior. So that's, I think, a second option. And then the third option is to say, look, you know, you can make their reputation visible to them and hope that that motivates them to earn a new one. So a few years ago, I was working with a financial services company, and they had a woman named Kathy who got a promotion, and she was told she was going to lead a new team with this guy that today I'll call Colin, because that's his name. Colin, you know, he just had a horrible reputation, and four different people came up to Kathy and said, don't trust this guy. He's going to steal credit for your ideas. He's going to dump all the grunt work on you. Watch your back with Colin. And Kathy sat down with him in their very first one-on-one and said, Colin, I understand we're going to be leading a team together, and I just wanted to let you know, this is what I've heard about you. And she shared all the reputational feedback. And Colin's response was priceless. He's like, I don't know who you've been talking to, but clearly these people are all jealous of me. And we're like, okay, Colin, now we know you're a taker. Then Kathy said, look, I don't know whether it's true or not, you know, honestly, but I can tell you that I don't like working with people who operate this way. If this is who you are not going to like working with me. And for the next year and a half, Colin changed his stripes. He shared credit, he mentored, he volunteered for unpopular projects. And I think what Kathy did is she helped him see his own reputation through the eyes of others. And then she invited him to change his reputation. Said, look, you know, I don't know whether this is true or not. And, you know, I don't think you want to go and call anyone a taker to their face. But sometimes gently letting them know, look, this is how you're perceived. You know, I've heard, you know, there are a few people who are saying they don't trust you. And here are some of the behaviors that I'm, you know, that I'm aware of. And, you know, I don't think that's how we want to operate around here. It's a conversation occasionally worth having.
I think it's a great conversation we're having with people perhaps who are behaving that way. And one of the things I love about Give and Take is you offer so many practical small ways perhaps we can lean more towards being effective givers. So what do you find? What are some of your favourite ways that you found work for most people in terms of becoming more effective givers in workplaces?
Well, I think it pretty much boils down to being thoughtful about your helping decisions around who you help, when you help, and how you help. So, you know, the who is, look, we all have people that, you know, that we either were friends with them or, you know, we naturally empathize with the position they're in. And of course, we want to help those people. We don't want to forget, though, that we should also help the people who are making requests that are actually relevant to organizational goals, right? So one of the ways you protect yourself from overextending yourself as a giver is you try to make sure that the time you spend helping other people actually contributes to, you know, your team's objectives or your organization's mission. The when is basically about saying, look, I'm not going to drop everything anytime people ask me for help. I'm going to block out windows in my calendar to get my own work done, and then I'll have separate periods available to be helpful to other people. And of course, in emergencies, you know, I might end up shifting that a little bit, but I have to progress on my own goals, not just, you know, support people with theirs. And I think what a lot of givers need to realize is, look, there's nothing wrong with being ambitious for yourself, just as you're ambitious for others. It's perfectly reasonable to say, look, I want to help other people succeed, but I care about my own success too, and I want to try to balance those two as effectively as I can. And then the third piece, the how, I think is the one that most people miss. It's the question of what kind of helping are you doing all day? And the sad reality is that most of us live in a world where we react to the requests that come to us. 75 to 90% of all helping starts with a request. And so, you know, most of the time, it's like whatever people decided to put on our plate is what we're reacting to. And the key here is to go into proactive mode and say, look, there's certain types of giving and helping that I enjoy and excel at. For me personally, what I love most are sharing knowledge and making introductions. And so, you know, anytime somebody reaches out and says, you know, is there a study on, if it's in, you know, the realm of work and psychology, I feel like it's, you know, it's something I ought to know. And then also, you know, can you help me meet this person or, you know, this kind of person? If it's mutually beneficial, it's incredibly fun to connect people together. And so, yeah, if it were up to me, I would spend almost all my helping time on all the, on those two kinds of requests, only I get all sorts of miscellaneous requests. Would you give me feedback on my book or my paper? I kind of have too many of those requests already. I'd rather not, but I really want to be helpful. Is there something else I can do? And, you know, the list goes on. And so, you know, I guess personally, I've been trying to practice what I've seen in lots of successful givers, which is they actually start to give on their own terms. And they will broadcast to people, look, you know, these are the ways of helping that I enjoy and that I think I might have unique value to add. And so if I can be helpful in these areas, please let me know. And what's nice about that is then you get to give on your own terms as opposed to whatever happens to come to you. What's also nice, and this is especially relevant for women and minorities, is, you know, the danger of being known as a giver is pretty soon no good deed goes unpunished. And so if you're just like, if you're known as successful and willing to be helpful, then, you know, you just get this reputation as a nice person who can be bothered anytime. And what you really want is a reputation as an expert whose time is valuable. And that way people will come to you sort of on their, you know, on the areas that you really have distinctive expertise in. And I think getting clear about like, what are the few ways that you really want to contribute to others, as opposed to how can I say yes to as many people as possible, is a key transition for a lot of givers.
So for me, practically, one of the tips I loved in Give and Take was the work you shared of Adam Rifkin on a 5-minute favour. And so I try most mornings, you know, to do a little 5-minute favour for somebody. And perhaps it's just a, you know, sample size of one of Michelle McQuaid. But it helps me to think of that 5-minute favour as part of my act of kindness for the day as well. I guess, are you seeing research that suggests those strengths of kindness interact with being an effective giver? Or is that just something that's working for me personally?
You're not alone, Michelle. So there's a great study that Sonia Libomirsky and her colleagues just published showing that if you do just like five-minute favors per week at work, your job satisfaction goes up and your life satisfaction goes up. And I don't think most people find that surprising. We know that helping others gives us a source, like a sense of meaning, a source of purpose. It allows us to feel, you know, valued and appreciated by others and maybe even deepen our relationships with them. What may be more surprising to a lot of people is that the receivers of those 5-minute favors, on average, paid it back about 278%.
Wow.
And, you know, a lot of that comes from gratitude, right? Mm. So let's say you helped me. I feel really grateful. And I know that, you know, the best way to honor your act of generosity is not to help you back, but to pay it forward and, you know, try to establish this norm. And so I think, you know, one thing that we often don't get to see is when you do those 5-minute favors, you know, what's the ripple effect? And how does that cascade and influence the generosity of other people? And if we can get enough people operating this way in an organization, you can actually start to change the organization's norms and values.
I have completely seen that and run my own little experiments in a team where we were doing an act of kindness for people regularly, and the tidal wave of gratitude that came back into that team and then buoyed us up during a really difficult change process was just phenomenal to see. But I have to say, one of the other bits that really resonated with me on your research on effective givers was, you know, that being able to set some boundaries around when and how we give and trying to grow the pie for everybody rather than just being people pleasers who are saying yes because we're too scared to say no. And for me, I've been playing a lot with the practice of self-compassion from Kristen Neff's research.
Sure.
And I do find, though, I need some self-compassion as I'm saying no or not getting to everybody or feel like I'm letting people down. Again, do you think this is a Michelle McQuaid sample of one thing, or do you think self-compassion might be one of the ingredients that help us be effective givers?
Yeah, I think it's probably an increasingly important skill as people's careers advance. And as they get busier, because you just add up all the people you know. If you tried to help even a fraction of them every day, you would do nothing else. So it's just, I think we have to realize, look, like we're all human. Nobody can help all the people all the time with all the requests. And in fact, if you can, you're not being strategic enough about, you know, about what your impact is and where you can really contribute. And so I think that, you know, self-compassion is a skill that allows us to recognize, look, you know, we shouldn't hold ourselves to impossible standards. Just because we weren't able to say yes to every request does not mean that we are fundamentally bad human beings. And there are lots of other people who have been in our shoes. It's interesting. One of the things you hear over and over again from like the Warren Buffetts and Bill Gateses of the world is that the difference between successful and very successful people is the ability to say no. Mm-hmm. And it's not, though, that they're saying no because they're jerks or because they don't care about others. It's because they recognize that every time you say no is a chance to say yes when it matters more. And, you know, kind of starting each week or each month with a sense of where do you really want to make a difference is a better guide to, I think, to contributing to others most of the time than saying, well, what are people asking of me?
One of my favorite articles of yours, and I often share it, is how to say no nicely. And so we'll put it in the cheat sheet from today's podcast because I find those tips very useful. I've practiced most of them at this point. I often get asked, Adam, though, when I share your research in organizations, is there ever any situation where as a leader you might actually want takers in your team?
I used to think the answer is yes, but I've become convinced that I was wrong. So I think that it's tempting to say, well, you know, sometimes you need people who are hard charging and aggressive and who won't take no for an answer. And, you know, organizations, every organization can land in a situation where those mercenaries are necessary. And you could also say, well, you know, maybe there's an evolutionary reason why, you know, we have givers, takers, and matchers in the world. And people say without, you know, without takers, there can be no givers. False. Totally wrong. Without takers, there can be more givers, because what you have then is not givers and takers, you have givers and receivers. Taking is using somebody for personal gain, exploiting somebody else. Receiving is saying, look, I'll accept somebody else's contribution with gratitude and then maintain a willingness to pay it back or pay it forward if the opportunity presents itself. And that makes giving much more sustainable than if somebody is just taking, which is much more zero sum. I think the reason that you don't want takers in your organization is the moment that their personal goals start to diverge from the organizational goals, you actually have somebody that you can't trust, right? Loyalty just goes out the window because by definition, takers put themselves first. And I think there are two alternatives to working with takers that may accomplish the, you know, some of the objectives that are in mind when people say, well, yeah, but we need takers. Well, first of all, you may think you want takers to deal with other takers, but matchers are just as good at that, if not better. And the great thing about matchers is like they really believe in an eye for an eye. And so they will be extremely tough on takers. But unlike takers, they'll be generous with givers and fair with fellow matchers. And so you can trust them to actually be committed to and loyal to your organization. The other way that I think you can get the benefits of some of takers' habits without the cost is to really invest in disagreeable givers. And you're familiar with this, but I think a lot of people assume that givers are always nice and warm and friendly, and there's this whole group of givers who are grumpy and gruff and tough and challenging and critical, but not because, you know, they have bad intentions toward others. They're that way because they believe that's the most effective way to help others succeed. It's like a rugby coach, right? who sees a lot of potential in you and is not going to let you slack off. And, you know, the great thing about disagreeable givers is they give a ton of critical feedback. They hold people accountable to very high standards, but they do it to try to help people, you know, sort of achieve what they're capable of.
Yes, I've come across many disagreeable givers, and often they've become my best champions because they challenge me in ways that get me out of my comfort zone and don't let me get away with being less than I can be. So I love this idea of disagreeable givers and how do we celebrate the role that these people play in our workplaces. I'm fascinated that one of your recent studies with Facebook found that the most important driver of people's engagement at work was pride in the company. So what did you find predicted people's pride, and why do you think this is so significant?
So I think I'll answer them backward. I think it's significant because normally when we focus on employee engagement, we assume it's all about, your work. Like, you know, do I get to use my strengths? Do I love my job? And your relationships? Do I have a best friend? Do I have a great boss? And we forget about the fact that a huge part of your engagement is the strength of your connection to your organization. And yeah, at Facebook, we did find that feeling proud to work at Facebook was the single biggest driver of engagement if you work there. And there were three consistent drivers of pride. One was optimism about the future, feeling like, you know, Facebook is not going to be a dinosaur. And if you work in an organization, you want to believe it's going to be better next year than it was this year, that it's moving forward, making progress, accomplishing something bigger. The second factor was basically a sense of mission and commitment to the mission. So, you know, not only knowing that the organization has a clear and compelling vision, but being passionate about it. So in the Facebook case, they actually just rolled out a new mission recently and, you know, added that it's not just about sharing, it's about building community. And, you know, feeling attached to that mission, believing in that mission, of course, makes you prouder of the organization. And then the third factor was social good. So it's one thing to say, look, you know, this company's best days are ahead of it, and I really believe in the mission. It's another thing to say, this company make the world a better place. I think there are a couple of factors at play. I think that when you believe that your organization does work that improves the world around you, it makes you feel like your time is well spent, like your actions have real significance in the world and that they contribute to something that's bigger than you.
I think that's so important. And some of your research I love is around that meaning in workplaces and how do we feel like we're making a positive difference to somebody somewhere, even if it's just the person next to us. And it's research I share a lot. And the work that you've talked about on service mindsets as well, how do we embrace those service mindsets in organisations? There are still 101 questions I'd love to ask you both about the resilience work and the originals work that we're not going to get to today, but I would love to have you back at any stage, and I highly recommend people grab both option B and the originals. Again, there's so much richness in there, I think, for us to help improve our workplaces. But in the interest of time and respect for your time particularly, Adam, are you ready for the lightning round?
I'm ready.
So I'm curious, of all the research you've played with, what insight, tool, or practice has made the biggest difference in your own life and why?
That is so hard to do in lightning. It's like the longest answered question of all.
Give it your best shot.
If I had to do it in lightning round, I would say it's probably the research that's made the biggest difference in my life actually is the research on task significance and beneficiary contact, which, you know, started with a mentor of mine, Richard Hackman, showing that if you work in a job that benefits other people, that's a critical source of motivation. And I guess I was surprised in my own research by how much it mattered to not only know that your job had an impact on others, but actually meet those people and see the difference you were making. And I guess, you know, the way I've tried to incorporate that into my life is I try to make sure that I don't completely lose contact with the people I'm trying to reach, whether it's, you know, hearing from readers of my books or actually seeking feedback from the audience afterward on what resonated in a speech and what I can do more effectively. That's, of course, useful for learning, but it also helps me understand if the work I'm doing is actually meaningful. That was so not lightning. What's the next one?
I think that's a great tip. If we take your own wonderful books as a given, is there something else you'd recommend when it comes to bringing out the best in people in workplaces, and what would it be?
There are two books coming out that I love reading. One is called Supernormal by Meg Jay. She's a clinical psychologist, and she explores some of the factors in our early lives that make us more resilient and yet make us feel less resilient. And I found it to be a really moving book that taught me more about resilience than anything else I've read. The other one is The Culture Code by Dan Coyle. Dan dives into some of the greatest cultures in organizations around the world and makes sense of what makes them so powerful. Why do people feel so connected? Why do they do their best work in these cultures? And how can you create one like that? And I think it's the best book written on culture. So Supernormal and The Culture Codes.
Awesome. I'm going to go and check those out. And lastly, if there was one thing you wished everybody thought about when it comes to bringing out the best in themselves and others in workplaces, what would it be?
If there was only one thing, it would be, I really believe that the most meaningful way to succeed is to help other people succeed. And I don't think that enough people spend enough time asking themselves, who do I want to help? What contribution do I want to make? And how can I best spend my time to make sure that happens?
I think those are great questions to leave us with. Adam, thank you so much for joining us today.
You are very welcome. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening. For more information on Adam's wonderful work, be sure to check out his website at adamgrant.net, where you can find all his best-selling books and his TED Talks. There are also some great tools to assess your relationship beliefs and your originality on his site. And as always, we'll put these URLs into the show notes for you. You've been listening to Making Positive Psychology Work with Michelle McQuaid. To grab your special Making It Work cheat sheet from today's podcast and some of the tested practical ways Adam suggests you can be a more resilient, original and effective giver at work, simply visit michellemcquaid.com/podcast58. That's michellemcquaid.com/podcast58. And if you'd like to perform a random act of kindness today, then share this podcast with a friend or colleague to help improve our workplaces. After all, as Martin Luther King Jr. wisely said, we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly, affects all indirectly. Until next time, take care.